Don't worry, this won't be in the show.
All right, Tuesday, what are we at? May 29th, almost the end of May. Well, pretty much is the end. Wait, 30 days has September, April, June. So there is there are 31?
Yep.
31 days?
Yeah. I think Friday is.
All right, so Tuesday, May 29th, episode 318 of your On Taking Pictures podcast.
Ooh, changing it up today.
Changing it up. Of your On. It's like that Ryan's. These are your American Idol, like that whole thing that he used to do. Does he still do? Is that show even still on? Is it on still?
Yeah, I do believe it is. Yeah. I think actually somebody just won, and then the two people who were last, I think the woman won. It was a man and a woman, and then it came out
was
right
it Justin
after,
and Kelly,
yeah, essentially. And then it came out as one of them won that they had been started dating, so it was very cute. I think that's what it was.
It's Justin and Kelly all over. Are they going to do a movie? Is it going to be a beach movie?
I hope so.
Wasn't that his name?
Jason. Jason? No, Justin.
Justin?
Oh, who cares?
Jason loves Kelly, or Kelly loves Jason or something?
Yeah.
Anyway. Anyway. Wow. Talk about a digress. So it's Bill in Brooklyn, it's Jeffrey in Silver Spring.
Yeah. You're nowhere near all that flooding, right?
No, but...
Holy cow.
Man, yeah, Ellicott City, which is just a few miles away. It's not really very far. I mean, you pass it going to BWI. But man, I mean, if you watch some of the videos, if you're interested, there's been serious flash flooding. And there used to be at Universal Studios, and I remember this when I was a kid, and then seeing it as an adult working at uni was a very strange experience. But there was a town that you would be going through. You know, you go through it on the tram on the backstage tour, and oh no, the tram stopped, and oh, a storm's coming through, yeah. And they would dump a ton water. Of water at the top of the street, and it would kind of peter out by the time it got to the fan or the tram.
Yep.
But. Man, seeing that much water where it's like moving cars and SUVs crashing into each other and then moving this pod of like three cars down the street.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Holy Christ, that's insane.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no, so it's not too close. We didn't really get hit very hard.
Oh, really?
Knock wood.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no. It rained a lot more. I mean,
north
even
of
just,
you, apparently.
North got hit. Baltimore got hit. But we, thankfully, did not. And it was pretty good. And we went and had ice cream sandwiches.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. This place called the Baked Bear. A Baked Bear. Anyway.
I'm always more into the cookies than the ice cream.
Yeah. These were tasty. I'd never had one before. And it was like you choose your cookie, right, top and bottom. You can mix it up. You can do a brownie. You can do a donut, whatever. And then ice cream in the middle. And then they put it on this, like, almost like a little panini press where it warms up the cookie on either side.
Sure.
Shit. So good.
Is there an option for an insulin injection?
I think there's a crash cart right on the way out. Clear. Bill, there was like a half hour line just to go in this place.
Oh, no. I don't wait for food. Not
it
like
was
that.
Nuts.
I'll go back, when it's not Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah. Well, that was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had lobster this weekend because the wife wanted lobster rolls up at my mother's house, and
right.
So we went and picked up seven lobster at the lobster place, and.
Now, do you do them with mayo or butter?
Oh, no,
one is New England and one is
Connecticut style, which is
what's Connecticut style,
which is hot with butter.
Okay.
Not cold with mayo.
Cold with mayo, is that Cape Cod style?
That's like Maine style. Like that's north. Cold is more north. Connecticut style is basically just chunks of lobster with butter on a toasted roll. That's the way to go, Connecticut style. But we had those, which is just very weird. If you think too much about lobsters and you think they're just like basically giant cockroaches from the sea that you cook and pull the stuff out of, much less appealing.
Well,
you say it like that.
Put it like that. I mean, Here, have this cockroach of the sea. Nobody wants that. Who wants that?
Yeah, it's like there was some prison thing from 18-something where the prisoners or the people in the insane asylum or whatever it is demanded that they don't have to eat lobster more than twice a week or something. You know, it was like part of their, because they were rioting and that was one of their demands.
Because they were cockroaches of the sea?
Well, because, you know, they were just cheap and easy, whatever it is. It's like somehow the market turned lobster into this delicacy. And it really only is a delicacy when it's just dipped in, like, steeped in butter, you know. Doesn't have that much taste otherwise. Exactly. It's just a butter carrier, man. All right, what were we talking about before we started? Oh, we were talking about still life.
Well, you were talking about this phantom. This
I got some hands-on time on
a phantom flex camera. It's one of these cameras that shoots thousands of frames per second.
Yes, exactly. So it's a high-speed camera. It's like what they used to use on MythBusters, I guess. Right. And other things like that. And they use it now for commercials and stuff. And I was at a guy's studio who does that kind of stuff for a living. And he's a monster at that kind of stuff. Steve Gural, who we talked about a few weeks ago. You brought him up.
If you've ever seen like a can of soda flying across the screen into a, you know, waterfall of pouring soda or water and it splashed, that's a phantom. Or if you've ever seen a burger flying in slow mo, that's probably a phantom. Fair to say?
Yeah. Although I think you can do 1080p. Well, you can do higher frame rate. You can do up to 200 frames per second on a RED, but I think it crops the sensor, so it's much harder to do. But yeah, essentially you can use a RED to do, or I mean, I'm sorry, a phantom to do these slow motion things. And I just got some time on it and I got to help them out next week, but it is really interesting how different doing still life shoots is, especially still life video, still life in general, but still life videos certainly, than shooting, say, people, which is what I do. It's just a completely different sense of time. You know what I mean? Where, you know, we're setting up a single shot for an hour and a half and we're looking over everything and we're testing and testing and testing. And then we try it and try it and try it 10 times until, you know, the whipped cream on top of the cake is perfect, you know, for that kind of thing. And then you said, oh,
so you're exploding whipped cream at 2000 frames a second or something.
Yeah. And there's such unknowns to it, you know, where you're shooting super tight macro shots of someone, you know, frosting a cake, and you get exactly the curl, you know, on a piece of cream cheese frosting that you were trying to get the whole time or whatever.
How do they make the peanuts disappear and the peanut butter appear as the knife's going across the bread?
I don't know, man. That's amazing.
That's what I want to know.
They're magic peanuts, Jeffrey. but it's amazing in photography how we all carry cameras. We're all talking about this, but the people who listen to this show, some are wildlife photographers, some are people photographers, some are, you know, street photographers, some are landscape, some are still life. And even though we're all using the same tool, it's a little bit like writing where, yeah, I'm a writer, but I write technical manuals. And the other guy says, you know, I write abstract poetry or whatever.
Right.
You're both using a pen on a piece of paper, but they're completely different.
But the interesting thing about, and this is why I wanted to kind of get this into the show, was this is one of the few areas of photography where, unless I'm missing something, there is no recreational use of this equipment. You know, you use your camera to make money and use it commercially, but you could also just go wander around and take photos with it. You know, listeners out there that are using full frame or crop sensor or micro four thirds professionally or semi-professionally, you could take that same hardware and go use it for pleasure, recreationally.
True.
Nobody's going to wander around with, you know, a Phantom or an 8K RED, except Marquez, just as a recreational camera, just to go shoot video or shoot pictures. So I find it really interesting that Steve, apparently, I don't know the man, but assume that he has this passion for photography, but it's a very narrow band of photography and video.
And he's a very strong portrait photographer, too. He used to do a lot of editorial portraiture, and he kind of, I don't know exactly the story of how he fell into this side of stuff. But there was that. Okay, two things to say. One, there was that video. Remember that music video where the guy basically had a phantom out the window of a car driving down the street in New York? Do you remember that? And it was like super slow motion of people like crossing the street as
yes,
the camera
I
was
do
panning.
Remember that. I don't remember the who did it,
we
but I do remember
about it
seeing
on the show.
It.
I think yeah, a million yeah. years ago. We'll try to find that. But I think that the other question is, I mean, if you're doing it, what is the word you used for leisure? What is that the word?
Yeah, or recreation.
Recreation. I mean, even the people doing it for recreation, though, aren't we all still trying to make something pretty? You know what I mean? Somebody could.
Yes.
If you were,
yeah.
If
I guess
rich,
I'm just saying that
buy one.
There's a different technical requirement.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, you're spending tens of thousands of dollars on this camera and the glass and all the rest of it in order to watch a piece of popcorn popping for 16
minutes. That's all I'm trying to get out is few are the people that are going to load up with this much equipment and go.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the other interesting thing about the way he does it is that he builds his own LEDs too.
Oh, so, panels, lighting panels.
Well, big panels like 2x4 foot ones with like the strips of LED you can buy on those like printed circuit strips.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. He's
got, they come in a big spool, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure the ones that he's using are high voltage ones or high output ones compared to your average one. But he basically has covered boards with those, and then he runs them off of electric bicycle batteries in order to have no ripple in the line so they don't flicker at high speed, that kind of stuff. So he's got all this like custom stuff that he's built in order to do the stuff he wants to do at high speed, like get enough light and stuff, which is also kind of interesting and fun and techie and nerdy and all those things too. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely not the kind of thing you do for fun unless you happen to be independently wealthy and want to do high speed photography, you know? But yeah, it's a different world. And there's a level of collaboration too. I mean, how many people are involved to get one shot? It's not just him standing there. It's him and six people, standing around. Each have a slightly different job, especially when it involves food and making food look good and taste good. And, this needs to look good for the next 3 hours on set and, in the middle of lights and not droop too much. So, we got to make that frosting extra stiff or whatever the thing is, right?
Yeah. If it even is frosting, maybe it's some other material.
Yeah. Well, all the stuff that I've ever seen him do is the actual food, because when we're done with the shoot, they cut it up and stick it on plates and people can eat, which is kind of neat. But it is definitely a very different way of working. And very specialized and kind of fun to do something completely different and to watch somebody work completely differently in a process that you go, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. I don't know that I have the patience to do that all the time. It's just a different, it's like time is in slow motion.
Right.
It both in both real time and the recorded time, it's just like lots of, okay, well let's consider this and move this around and,
Right. And you're talking about hours or even days of prep and execution for 2.5 seconds.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other thing, But anyway, it was interesting and fun. Was there something else you wanted to say about that, or did you?
No, I found it fascinating because it's a side of photography that I know that I don't see much of, and
you and I just don't do that.
I don't have any firsthand experience, unlike you, who've like been to the place and been in the presence of is it Geralt? Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah.
Geralt, Steve Geralt.
But I mean,
look him up on Instagram if you guys don't follow him. Steve Geralt. I think it's Geralt Engineering or Geralt Photo Engineering.
I think it might be Steve Geralt, but he says that he's a image engineer or something like that.
But he'll put up the final products, and then he'll put up some behind the scenes things, and it's really cool stuff. I mean, I've been following him for a while, and I'm a big fan.
Yeah. So that's cool and fun, something different. Jeffrey,
well, I think anytime you get out of your comfort zone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to see somebody who is really good at what they do doing it too is also a really interesting thing, because there's no mystery to it, you can watch him and go, okay, yeah, he needs this much light because he's this frame rate and this kind of thing. So he's got these turned on and this, you know, there's not a lot of technical mystery to it. It's just a matter of doing it really well at a very high level, you know, and especially when you're shooting stuff like that and the clients are there and they're in the other room watching the monitors as you're working and saying, yeah, that's what we wanted, or nope, do it again. Or, you know, try this or try that. Or how about if we can you get it more splashy, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's his job, is to make people happy. So it's
there is a here. I don't know if I'll be able to find it. If not, I'll put it in next week. Fielding sent me an article. Let's see. O-T-C-H-I-N-G. Watching. Anyway, there's this article that she sent me about how watching people do something makes us think that we can do it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. There's research that watch, here it is. Here it is. Harvard Business Review. Watching an expert do something makes you think that you can do it too.
Yeah.
You can find just about any skill. This is from the article. You want to learn on the internet. Steve Jobs' captivating presentation style, Steph Curry's jumper, Michael Jackson's moonwalk, all of these are easily accessible. Clearly, instructional videos, how-to yep. guides, online tutorials have changed the way we learn, or have they? Watching expert performances might make you feel like you could perform similar skills, but new evidence suggests that learning by observations may at times be illusory. Observers come away feeling confident that they're well prepared to try the task out themselves, but when they do, often they're not better than they were before. So this is kind of an interesting.
I think that though the difference there is, well, not the difference, but the point is that people watch somebody and they think that they can do it just because they've watched them. Is that the idea?
It's part of it. Yeah, I'll send you.
I think the thing for me, and when it comes to that kind of stuff, is a little bit like when Tony Hawk talks about, you know, people doing crazy tricks and flips and things like vert skating things. Like, oh, once Tony Hawk did a 720, other people could do it because we knew it was possible. You know, you ever hear like that
yes,
kind of talk?
Yes, but it's not. It's I'm not going to go watch a YouTube video and go land a 720. These are people who have been practicing and skating for
absolutely.
Years.
Yeah. But I guess what it is that when you see that there's no magic inherent in something, it makes it go, oh, that's an achievable goal. Somebody has achieved it. So now mm-hmm. going and working at it doesn't feel like like there's some sort of X factor that doesn't exist. You know what I mean? That's in there. And it could be that somebody's, you know, I'm never going to shoot three-pointers like Steph Curry, certainly. You know, I just have no hand-eye coordination skill, you know. But for somebody who's a really good basketball player, they might go, oh, the way he's doing that, that actually is a good idea, and it makes them a better
absolutely.
Shooter.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. But yeah. there is either a built-in propensity or there is a history of engaging in the activity as a precursor.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you think that this is, and ooh, I'm going to open up a can of worms here. Do you think that this is part of the problem with the sort of stereotypical millennial culture, which is like, well, I've been at this company for 6 weeks and so I could be the CEO because, you know, I've seen the CEO do his job, you know, that sort of classic.
I think
story.
There's a problem. Yeah. I think it speaks to a problem of anybody going, well, how hard could it be? You know, they look at it and they go, well, that doesn't look that difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, writing a sentence is pretty easy, but, you know, writing The West Wing for 8 years or writing The Godfather Hemingway or Faulkner or whatever, that doesn't make it easy. And watching someone do it, I think it can have an effect, and maybe you can see, to your earlier point, you can see specific techniques, the way someone stands, the way they hold a pen, the way they hold their camera.
Right.
You know, years ago, McNally had Joe McNally.
His little stance.
yeah, has his little stance where he's basically kind of going over the top of the camera with one hand and firing with the other, and it allows him to get slower shutter speeds. And I, when I had my D300, I tried it, and it, I got better results.
Right,
it doesn't
make
is it going to make me Joe McNally? Of course not.
No, gels but, and speed lights.
That's right. That many, many speed lights.
Love you, Joe.
But the you know, the idea of, I mean, this also gets at the myth of self-taught, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there is any such thing as self-taught. I think that's a misnomer. I think I get what you're trying to say. I get what the thought behind it is, but unless you're in a vacuum figuring out all of this stuff on your own without looking at influence, without looking at books, magazines, YouTube videos, whatever, other people,
right,
you're not self-taught because you are being influenced by those people,
sure,
around you. You're
sort
being
of
influenced.
Passively taught.
Yeah, yeah. But the self-taught is another one of those words like iconic that I kind of ranted,
yeah,
about earlier.
I think that there are two things going on here. I think that watching somebody who's really good at something can make you feel like it's easier than it is. But
yes,
then I think that there are other people who are involved in a task or do a task or talk about some skill who make it sound like it's harder than it is. And I'm not talking like some advanced skill like shooting three pointers. I'm
right,
talking about like, you know, like, I don't know, Jeffrey, I don't know if you could become a pilot. It's well, no, I'm a pretty bright guy who can figure that out. I think you could become a pilot. You know what I'm saying?
I know I could become a pilot. I used to fly my dad's plane.
Exactly. But you see what I'm saying, though? That, like,
could
a lot
I
of
do
people
a
would
barrel
be...
roll in a helicopter like Tom Cruise? No.
Oh, eventually you might be able to.
Maybe, but I wouldn't get into a helicopter.
I wouldn't get into the damn thing. By the way, that trailer looks pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, okay, let's digress real quick.
Yeah.
Say what you want about Tom Cruise and his weird personal life. The guy is a consummate professional when it comes to making movies.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I don't know him, but based on many, many interviews with people who have worked for him, with him,
he's a pro.
The guy is a pro.
Yep.
So yeah, the trailer does for the new Mission Impossible. I'll go see it.
And
I'll give him my $12 just to go, you know what? I feel really bad that you broke your foot on this take.
Every time they show that take on the, because it's in the movie and in the trailer.
Yeah.
It hurts.
But Bill, the fact that if they, you know, they show that shot from the front, he climbs
going
up on top of the roof and hobbles out of frame to mm-hmm. finish the shot.
Yeah.
Pro.
By the way, I saw that preview last night while seeing Solo, and I liked it. I liked it better than Rogue One.
I
you disagree?
I still think it was a bad. I haven't seen it, but I think it was a bad direction to go. I think they should have done, like I told you a couple weeks ago, I think it should have been a Lando movie. Based
on
the clips,
that one too.
I don't dig the guy that is playing Han.
Oh, okay. He comes off better in the movie than he does in the trailers, and the movie itself was actually kind of fun.
Okay.
So I you know, for what it's worth, I liked it better than Rogue One, which I thought was way too serious and didn't really feel like Star Wars to me. This felt like Star Wars to me.
Huh. Okay.
Interesting. So for what it's worth. But anyway, back to the other thing, like, you know what I'm talking about, where people kind of make things sound harder than they are. Like, oh, you could never do that. You know what I mean? Or like, oh, it's really difficult. I don't know. It's like, no, you can. There are a lot of skills that just involve some
yeah.
time and attention and studying and whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I could become a lawyer if I really wanted to go to law school. You know, it's not an impossibility. You know,
sometimes I don't want to know.
I don't
want to know how it's done. I mean, when I talked to Ben Thomas, you know, we were walking around D.C. and we were talking about his color. And he's like, well, I mean, I can tell you how I do it. I went, nope. He's like, really? I said, no, I don't want to know how you do it. Yeah. You earn that. That's yeah. that's your thing. You figured that out. I don't want to just glom onto it. And then that's when, you know, everybody starts doing it. Same thing. I just talked to Gareth Lewis, a terrific photographer from Australia, and we were talking about color, and he said same kind of thing, and I could tell you how I do it, and I went, nah, I don't want to know.
Yeah, but also, aren't you also argue a lot of times that people should share their skills and their knowledge and their
absolutely
techniques?
Fine, share it, but I don't
you
personally
don't
feel the need to know.
You're saying if Ben Thomas made a video of how he does it, which allows other people to maybe take it another step further in a different direction,
Great for them, but I don't want to know.
You don't.
I don't feel the need to watch it.
You don't want to know the secret.
No.
Interesting.
No. No.
Okay.
I don't, because that was, you know, there were hundreds or maybe even thousands of little decisions, little experiments, little right turns, left turns, happy accidents that led him to that process. And for me to just go in and go, oh, well, now I know. I don't know. For me, and this is just me, I don't need to know that. If I happen upon it and go, oh, so that's how he did it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's one thing. But to just sort of take that thing and then start passing it off as if I've figured it out, that's not me.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a... Yeah, the whole learning process is a strange thing because there are times when you want to figure it out for yourself, and then there's times when you need a hint, you know?
Absolutely.
I just need a little something. Oh, it's this tool. Oh, okay, don't tell me anything more. Okay, I think I got it, you know?
Right, let me don't tell me everything. Let me get there. Let me climb, you know, some of it.
I play with the hue and the different color channels. Okay, yeah. Okay, don't tell me anything more.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah. No, I get it.
Yeah, I don't need a, you know, sort of Kelby-esque, you know, put the slider here, tick this radio button.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want that. Because then if I want to go anywhere further than that, I'm lost, right?
Well, yeah. Arguably, some people need the check this radio button.
Absolutely. And if
I'm
that's
definitely
you,
not one of them. Yeah.
Good on you. I don't want that type of instruction. I don't want that type of mentoring, tutorial, however you want to call it.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes when you go and you talk to people who are, a while back I was talking to this retoucher who had worked for a bunch of the big boys and was like this fancy person who was really good at it. And I was asking them all these sort of questions about, oh, you know, when they were doing this, that, and the other thing, because I knew stuff they had worked on or their studio had worked on. I said, did they try to get that color from the raw file, or do you guys export kind of neutral and try to do the color in post? You know what I mean? Like sort of workflow questions. And it's like,
yeah, where's your base coming from?
Exactly.
Kind of
it doesn't change the output, the final result. But it does change the way you look at the process, and then, you know, it's just interesting from a workflow point of view, you know.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you know, at first we used to do neutral and then do the color in post. And then time became of an essence, so we started doing the color in raw. But that actually sometimes kicked us in the butt because then they made a change halfway through and we'd have to go back to the raw file instead of just changing it or whatever. Mm. You know, so, but again,
you have to go further back to go forward.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
And it was interesting from my point of view, because at the level that I'm at with my own post-production, talking to somebody who's fancier, far fancier than me, and it's like, okay, here's the question I always had, and oh yeah, there's the answer, you know, that oh yeah, sometimes you do it the raw, sometimes you do it for these reasons, and you go, oh okay, yeah, that makes sense, you know. But
again,
it's not huge amounts of mystery, it's just decisions that are made somewhere, you know. And things, you know, that people say, oh, he would never let us do this. Or, you know, I work for this magazine sometimes and we're allowed to dodge and burn and that's it, you know, or whatever it is, right? Can't remove
a
hair.
We can't remove or add. Yeah,
nothing.
Sure.
You know, it's like all we can do is this. Now, wait, is that the photographer's choice or is that the magazine? Well, I don't know. We only ever work for this photographer for that magazine and it's his demand. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, where did it come from?
Right? But all these things are really interesting to me. From you know, they fill in pieces of my worldview, much like, you know, you always bring up Patrick's thing of if I can pull out one piece of information from a video or from a book or whatever, that adds to my kit. In some ways, these sort of workflow questions do that for me when I talk to people who are fancier and do things at a different level than me or do things that are different than me, you know, retouching still life stuff or whatever it is versus people versus, you know, yeah, it's I don't know. I find this stuff kind of fascinating. Where do you want to go? We have lots of stuff here.
Well, okay. So I found this article on, it's on PDN, which I love PDN. I wish everything, you know, more stuff was out in front of that paywall, but I get it. I get what they're trying to do. Anyway, it's an article on PDN called Finding the Creative Spark, Notes from PDN Photo Annual Winners.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of times these are clickbaity, linkbaity kind of, you know, 10 things to improve your
sure
whatever. But I think there are some interesting points that each of them hit. And some acknowledgement of what they do. There's a couple, Inez and Vindu, Vinood, I think it's Vinood. Follow them on Instagram. There's a link in the thing. And Inez says there's more of a fascination and a kind of obsession with the glamorous side of what we do. It's always been a little bit hard for people to understand that we can exist in both worlds and that we're independent of either world. It's a fine line that we balance on very deliberately because that's the most interesting to us, to be like a free agent and play with context on both sides. It's interesting where photographers find inspiration, whether it's from within their own discipline or genre,
yep,
or a completely different. You know, if you're a photographer, but you take inspiration from music or opera or sculpture or whatever.
Or about them traveling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a couple things in here. There's a guy called Christopher Anderson, second one in.
Yep.
And he says, I don't see a conflict between a picture that is aesthetically pleasing or beautiful and a picture that is informative or having some sort of meaningful content. I'm looking for something that's more emotional or ambiguous. That's what's interesting to me about photography. And I think this kind of gets us full circle to the top of the show where, you know, I go on and on about meaning and intent and narrative and those are things that are important to me, but I can also look at the work of Steve Giralt and appreciate the purely technical side of the process that has to fire on all cylinders to make that stuff possible.
Right. It's kind of exactly like this, and there isn't a lot of room.
Yes, and I think that's one of the superbly interesting things about photography is that there are infinite facets for sure. You to find inspiration from or that you can allow to inform your own work.
I think that whenever people ask me why I got into photography, I always tell them it's because it's a strange merger between the nerdy technical and the artsy fartsy, you know, aesthetic, right?
It's
you could be somebody who only ever thinks about f-stops and focal ranges and focal lengths and ISO and that kind of stuff. And you can make pictures that are technically perfect and maybe they're visually interesting, but to you, it's about technical perfection. You could go so far to the other side where you don't even know how the image is made. It just feels right to you and, you know, you're happy there. Or somewhere in the middle. And I, at times, get off on one end of that scale and at times get off on the other end of that scale. And so
yeah.
I can move within that range and not get bored. You know what I mean?
I can be
obsessive about technical stuff for a few months and then I can be obsessive about stuff that has nothing to do with technical for a few months and then flip-flop. It's what keeps it interesting. I think the best pictures, as he's saying, though, are the ones that sort of do both. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Or do all of those,
or that can do both, depending on who's looking at them.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a really terrific kind of nugget. There are a couple other things down here. There's one photographer. Her name, and I hope I don't butcher this, Dianita Singh. I believe is. Would you see? That's how you pronounce that?
I think that's pretty close.
Anyway, so she comes out with this set of books. And encourages you to pull out different pieces of her work and create kind of your own exhibition. So basically, remixing her work into something new, which I think is kind of neat. Like we have a sense of when we show work or when we share work that this is how it should be seen or experienced. And Ms. Singh here is kind of turning that on its head a little bit and saying, well, wait a minute, I know how this resonates with me, but what do you think?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of interesting. And then the last thing that I really loved, you know, I'm going to love this one.
Go ahead.
Stephen Shore interviewing Gregory Crudson. Come on.
The other way around, I think.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Gregory Crudson interviewing Stephen Shore. Sorry. But a conversation between the two of them.
Yep.
Now I have just found, I saw a little video of, there's a, a book that came out last year, Stephen Shore's Selected Works, 1973 to 1981, that looks like a beautiful book. So I think I'm going to order this.
You should consider getting the book from the MoMA show because it's quite good. And it is
oh, the Shore? Shore book?
Yeah. Because that show actually closed yesterday, I do believe it was, or 2 days ago on Monday. Sunday or Monday.
Stephen Shore, MoMA.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll
I love the design of the book. It looks really lovely.
Yeah, I do like the title on the type on the front cover.
I have not read this interview yet. I was kind of saving it until I got the book because I am not hugely familiar with all of Stephen Shore's body of work. I know some shots. I know some of the more popular or influential shots, but I would not say I'm as familiar with Stephen Shore as I am with Gregory Crudson.
Sure. I think that overall I like a lot of Stephen Shore's work, but I like very specific times of Stephen Shore's work. I like very particular sets of his work.
That's a parallel to Eggleston, isn't it? I mean, there are people that like are ravenous about very specific periods in Eggleston's career.
Yeah, but I think Eggleston's work to me is more consistent overall than Shore's work is.
Okay.
And not like in a quality sense necessarily, but just in a from period to period in Shore's work, you go, is this really the same photographer? Where Eggleston's work all still kind of feels like Eggleston to me.
Agreed.
I'll put a link to the Stephen Shore book from MoMA in the show notes, and I'll put a link to the other one too.
Yeah. And finally, something that we've just been talking about, Art Strieber on why sharing knowledge with other photographers benefits him.
And he's so great at that.
Yeah.
Great at that.
Yeah.
His is, I think, one of my favorite Instagram feeds for that reason.
Yeah.
Because he seems like he's genuinely just saying, oh, yeah, here I worked on the stuff with all these people and here's how we did it, you know.
Here's the wider context of what's going on.
Yeah, and he's shooting so much stuff that he can actually show the behind the scenes really easily, because he's got people who can take BTS shots. And a lot of his, he's a good example of lighting setups and you go, oh, yeah. Like, he's showing you what he's doing. And it's kind of like, okay, that's not different than what I would have done. So he's just doing it better than me. So what is he doing better? You know, is it a matter of being more incremental with the lights and getting worried about tenths of a stop? Or is it placement? Or is it post-production? Is it, you know, who knows, right?
But the fact that he's at least giving you kind of a rough blueprint of the scene or the setting,
Here's him and Spielberg taking the picture. Okay, well, there's nothing that he's doing that isn't in that picture. So what is he doing that's different than what you're doing? I love that kind of stuff. Makes me happy.
You might get a kick out of the next PD that's going up is with a guy called Simon Baxter.
Okay.
And he does a lot of drone work. He's got a YouTube channel. He does a lot of drone work. But his drone work, Bill, is phenomenal. And what he'll do is he'll either start the drone at the point of view of the photograph and sort of fly through the scene and then pull up and away so you can see the context of this landscape, or he'll go the other way. He'll start up high and sort of, you know, fly this thing deftly back through the scene and end up where he took the photo and then dissolve to the final photograph. So you get to see the context, very similar to the way Strieber does. Different type of photography, but same sort of premise is you're seeing, you know, from where he's set up and maybe even why he's set up that way. And I more and more, I like when photographers share how they arrived at a particular spot.
The only thing about all of that is just the amount of time it takes to do. Sometimes the BTS ends up becoming more of a time sunk than the actual taking the picture is.
Right.
So that is the only a thing. Or frustratingly, you don't have, like, I shot some behind the scenes video of all these ones I was traveling around doing for the magazine, except for the last one, because I had so little time with the guy that we didn't have time to take any video. And I'm like, don't 9 out of 10, you know, that I can show behind the scenes of, but, you know, it happens. But yeah, absolutely. I like when people make these videos. The question is, who are they making these videos for? Is it just other photographers just to share the wealth? Or is it a, well, if I do this and I share this and people get into my behind the scenes videos, my photography itself or videography or what have you will get more eyeballs on it?
But can you say that? I mean, I'm wondering what the goal is,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on who the person is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're Art Strieber and you have a small team of people on the shoot, you in theory don't have to take time away from what you're focused on to create that additional material.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Or it's not as much as if you were, you know, like you, one-man show or two-man show, trying to light and shoot the scene and,
yeah,
you know, focus on BTS and focus on, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and I would imagine it's...
If there's a producer there who can be shooting some video even on their phone or, you know, on an SLR, like then you have that. And, you know, that can totally work too. So yeah, it's a lot of... A lot of back and forth.
I love it. I mean, I think it's all part of the story, you know, and whether or not it ever comes out, you know, some people may shoot it with the intent of never showing it. They just want it for themselves.
Yeah. 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 Or shoot it and they put out the ones that are actually interesting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That I'm sure is an angle too. Very cool. So last weekend was the wedding of all weddings, Jeffrey.
Ugh.
Whatever. But there was a really kind of interesting little 5-minute thing with Alexei Lubomirsky, who is the fashion photographer who shot the wedding pictures and the group pictures of the royal family after the wedding, which I thought was actually kind of interesting. So I'll put a link in the show notes. He was on CBS this morning just talking about it for 5 minutes. And apparently he had about 25 minutes to shoot 6 setups, which, you know, obviously is really fast for his normal thing probably, but is not completely outrageous if you have teams of people and lots of light setup and stuff.
I wish they would have used that word setups. I'm looking at the article right now. And in the article, it's
six
had 25
photos.
Minutes to shoot 6 photos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not right.
6
is it?
Final photos is, you know, yeah. And I think the group pictures are nice. I would have known if I would have been interested. I'm assuming that he has lights set up to the left out of frame. You know what I mean? Because
I don't know, man. They could have used a reflector on Camilla. Her left side of her face is all in shadow from that silly hat.
Or Philip's eyes are a little sunken in, but.
Yeah.
They're obviously not heavily retouched. I'll give them that, which is actually kind of nice. And is it me or does that big picture that I think the one you're talking about feel like the tilt of it's a little off?
Yeah. Like
you could have tilted a little to the right or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. He's got to go off axis so he doesn't appear in. Is that that looks like a mirror behind
him. Yeah. Probably mirrors all the way down.
Yeah. So he's got to go a little off axis to get out of there. But yeah, it feels like. If you look at the perspective, like look at the top of the doors and look at the frieze over it's very strange. It feels a little of askew. It's tense, right? It feels tense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, 25 minutes, you've got 63 people in the damn picture. Most of them are kids.
Okay. But on the other hand, why only 25 minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, this is your queen. This is your grandson's wedding.
Yeah.
Come on. What's the rush?
Because they got other things.
You in a hurry
to get
the shrimp cocktail?
They
got
to get to the party. It is interesting, though, to me, because you're shooting people other than the kids. All of the people, you know, the mother, obviously all the adults in the room have had their picture taken 1,000 times.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
sure.
Meghan and Harry have had their picture taken 1,000 times by everyone from Mario Testino to whoever, you know. So I'm not surprised that these people, even the one of them sitting on the stairs or the black and white, it's like, are we really surprised these people are able to pose nicely? You know, like that's what they did for a living. These people have all been in magazines and stuff. They act as if like, how did you possibly get these normal people to get photos out of them? It's like, these
even
are
the one on
people.
The steps though, it feels a little off axis, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, it could be tilted a little to the right.
It feels just a little, we're splitting hairs here. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But interesting, 25 minutes is not outrageous because I've done things in 25 minutes and it happens, and he has, again, like I said, probably a team of six people who are wrangling and setting things up. And he even says, interestingly enough, he says in the video that he usually shoots a few shots and then we'll take a look on the screen and then, make changes or, that kind of thing. But he had so little time that he said, I just had to trust my assistants and say, look, I'm just going to keep shooting. If you see something that needs to change, that part of the dress is wrong, or look, his, you can see his socks there because you have to fix his hem of his pants or whatever it is. Like, let me know, because I'm not going to be looking for that. I just have to shoot, which is also probably very different for a guy who's this fashion photographer who generally just thinks about that stuff in a very concrete way. Anyway, I thought it was a little bit interesting. Those of you who shoot weddings and stuff will probably say, nope, that's totally normal for that amount of time, and he should suck it up.
Why did he only shoot 15 shots instead of 800 or whatever?
Yeah. Interesting nonetheless, in my opinion. Go ahead.
Nope, go ahead.
A little sad news. Apollo 12 moonwalker, fourth guy to walk on the moon, Al Bean, died the other day. The reason I bring this up and put it in the show notes is because Al Bean, when he left being an astronaut, became a painter, a full-time painter.
Yeah.
And painted these really lovely paintings of him and Conrad and sometimes Dick Gordon. Fantasy Dick Gordon, because Dick Gordon was up in the ship above them, but basically painted them on the moon. And when all of these guys left, they got to keep their mission patches, the things that were on their shoulders, from their suits. And they had them, and he said, I don't want these to go to my kids and they're just going to sell them or whatever it is. So he actually cut his up and would paint strands of them into his paintings.
Right.
So if you bought his paintings, they have like moon dust in them, essentially. Which is really kind of amazing. I talked to Al Bean in person and on the phone before over the years, and he was always a very, very sweet man. So I just wanted to say good for Al Bean, and somebody who finds an artistic pursuit in retirement that just consumes them and is a total second career is kind of amazing. I love that idea.
The end of the article, he says, quote, I think of myself not as an astronaut who paints, he added, but as an artist who was once an astronaut. So first love, really.
Yeah. Well, and certainly when he is an astronaut for 8 years or 10 years or whatever it is, and a painter for 40, that makes sense. So I don't know. I like that idea. And I like the idea of somebody. I think too often we separate people so that they are, if you're into science and math, you're not into aesthetics or whatever. Or, you're a fluffy artist and you don't care about real tangible things. And I think that is a continuum that's much more broad and cross-cultural than a lot of people make it out to be. It's not black or white. Here's a good example. So some really great pictures. I'll find some pictures of Apollo 12 because, man, I just can't ever get enough of looking at the pictures of them on the moon.
Or in the soundstage in Van Nuys.
Right, of course. Yeah. Of course. Jerk.
Burbank.
Jerk.
Hey, man, why are the reflections wrong?
Man, I can see the number on that rock. It's totally a piece. No, it's not. It's not any of that.
How come there's no moon dust on the landing gear? What's up with that?
Yeah. Ugh. I know some people who are moon landing deniers.
Really?
Yeah.
Like all conspiracy theorists?
I know a couple of people who are flat earthers.
Huh.
Yeah.
So
Jeffrey,
where's
I'm
Australia
to out you on television.
Yeah, right. You've outed me on the show. Damn it, Bill. Well then, okay, so if that's the case, then why has no one flown to the edge and got a photo looking back?
I don't know. What are you asking me for? It just makes me angry on so many levels.
I mean, seriously, if that's the case, then fly to the edge.
Just keep flying west and show me where it falls over like a waterfall.
Shoot back looking east and let's see it.
Yeah, but Jeffrey, the famous picture of the whole Earth is many pictures put together as a collage. It's like, okay, it could have been shot in one shot. They just didn't have a
wide
enough lens.
Right, but if you fly high enough, you can actually see the curvature. Come on, son.
Yeah. Good times.
Anyway. Hey, before we go any further, real quick, just popped up in my head.
Sure.
Do you still have a connection to Photo Plus? And are you going this year?
I don't know. I might, and I don't know if I'm going. When is it exactly? Do we know?
October 25, 27.
Why do you want to do a thing?
Well, yeah, I do. I want to go to it very much. And a couple photographers, Joshua K. Jackson and Craig Whitehead, known as Sixth Street Under, they're going to be here from the UK at some point in there.
Okay.
Nick Exposed, Nick Mayo, he might come out for it because apparently Jay is speaking. He's doing a lecture about something.
Okay. Well, yeah, we can talk about it when it's closer. The only thing that overlaps with is usually when my wife and I travel out of the country, but which it did last year, I do believe. But
okay.
But yeah, we can talk about it. Why, you want to do a live show or something?
I don't know. If anybody has a connection to it, please let me know.
Yeah. I'm sure
Bill
we can get
obviously
in.
Can't do anything.
Yeah.
You had one job, Wadman. One job.
You put me on the spot live in front of thousands of people.
All right.
So I just put this in here because I think it's funny. I found this the other day while looking for something else, and it's from January of last year. But it's kind of interesting that some people have figured out how to process Kodachrome without Kodachrome chem.
Process in quotes.
Yeah, it's a cross process, right? You're not going to get what you got from a true Kodachrome process. And some places will do Kodachrome processing, but they just give you black and white back. This woman, Kelly Shane Fuller of Privatology Studios, has been experimenting.
Piratology.
Oh, Piratology. What did I say?
Privatology.
Okay. Piratology. Sorry. And he's figured out basically a way to get color slides out of Kodachrome, which I just think the whole idea of cross-processing film is really interesting because it's just, you know, salts and photochemical stuff on plastic. The different ways you process it, you'll get different crazy color stuff like cross-processing E6 and C41 and vice versa, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I just think it's kind of neat. And he will process it, too, for $25 a roll, which is expensive.
It is.
But, you know, if you had a roll of Kodachrome that you never got processed and you desperately wanted to see what was on it, you know.
And have it not look like Kodachrome.
Yeah. Well, he says that the color is correct, but saturation is low. So I guess if you scanned it and bumped up the saturation, you might get close. I don't know. Just a thought.
I've been wanting to shoot some of this CineStill film. I saw a few photos that Jason posted, and then a couple other people have posted that I've really been intrigued by the look of it, particularly in the evening or at night. And Wilkening gave me a couple rolls of the 50, but I'd like to shoot the 800 as well.
The high-speed tungsten stuff?
Yeah. Have you ever shot any of this stuff?
I have not.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I mean, remember, was it last week or the week before that you put the thing in the show notes where it was a comparison of a bunch of different film stocks?
Mm-hmm.
People were talking about it. And yep. I think I said then, and I double it now, where it's just like, you know, I think that other than really specialty ones like Kodachrome, which really had a completely different thing, it's the differences certainly between black and white films are not that drastic to me. Or if you once you scan them and play around with a little curves, you could make any one of them look like pretty much any of the others, you know. I mean, I guess the grain structures look different. That could be an argument for stuff, but only if you're printing big enough that you actually see the grain. I think it's interesting. I tend to just stick, if I'm going to shoot film, I tend to stick with Ilford, Kodak, Fuji, you know what I mean? Just cause they're easily gettable, at least where I am. Do they sell this stuff in any stores, or do you have to order it online?
You can order it online. I have not seen. I mean, maybe B&H has it.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe I'll go by and see if I can get some. Yeah. I was running some black and white through my Leica the other day, and I have to finish the roll and bring it in and get it processed.
It's not hugely expensive. The 800T is, I think, $10 a roll for 36.
Yeah. What is B&H charge for, you know, Kodak? Like Tri-X is how much?
Probably
now?
$6 a roll, $7 a roll.
$5.69 a roll. Is that about what it always was?
You know, I don't remember because I pretty quickly started buying bulk rolls and loading myself.
Ah, okay.
So I don't remember what it was, you know, back in the day, as they say.
Yeah. Tri-X. I'm actually running out of film. I have a little bucket of film in my fridge for the occasional time I want to. You know, just stuff I bought years ago that I just haven't gotten around to shooting, and I need to. It's getting a little low. Whenever I go to put a roll of film, I'm like, oh, all I have is 100 speed slide Provia or Provia or whatever. Right? Like I don't have anything different in there. I gotta get back in there and replenish my stock. Yeah,
you gotta buy some new Ektachrome when it comes out.
Yeah, but wait, that's only 35 millimeter, right? Why do they got
to
do that?
I don't know. Is it only 35?
35 and 8 millimeters.
Oh, that's right. 8 millimeter. Right. Because all the
which
kids
is like, come on. 120, man. Yeah. Give me some 120. It's all I want in life. I don't ask for all that much.
But you do. Come on.
I'm kind of back in printer hell. You know, we talked about printing things last week.
I thought, you called me almost a week ago. Why didn't you just buy a new printer?
Well, I was going to buy. I needed to print
it
some
was
stuff
on sale,
for a portfolio.
You get a discount.
Yeah, I just didn't want to buy another printer that I'm going to end up throwing away in 2 years because the cartridges are expensive and the black ink head clogs up. You know,
right?
Like, I feel like if I'm going to buy a new printer, I'd rather spend $1,400 on a really good pro one that'll theoretically last longer. And you know what I mean? Is that crazy?
I don't know. Well, for $1,400, you're still, I mean, you're still sub
25,000. Yeah, you're at the high end 17 inch.
Yeah, you're at like an Epson P800 and a Canon
actually the P5000 you can get with rebate $400 rebate. It's $13.95.
Okay, and that's what 17?
That's a 17 inch, but it's
80
a big
milliliter,
17 inch.
Yeah, 80 milliliter cartridges.
Yeah. I do believe. Yeah.
So I mean, for those of you out there listening, 80 mil cartridges are, I don't know, they're about the size of a Klondike bar.
Oh, that's what it was. You know, last night I was sitting in bed thinking about what I was going to say about this, and I was like, Jeffrey likened the ink cartridges to some particular size, and now I can't remember what you said.
About the size of a Klondike bar. So, you know, what would you do for a Klondike bar full of ink? I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, are the higher end printers really any better?
I think on paper they are better because the they've got more nozzles. The nozzles are able to print in smaller, was it picoliters?
They're actually 200 mil cartridges in the
5000. Oh, 200, that's big. Yeah, so that's
pretty
like
pretty much never need to change your cartridges.
Yeah,
if you're
that's
a normal
like a size of like a VHS tape.
Yeah, exactly. So, yep.
And all you young kids out there are going, oh, what?
Yeah, exactly. sorry to cut you off.
Bigger
cartridges. So wait, more nozzles, bigger head.
More nozzles, which is smaller speed? Picoliters. In theory, more gradation, smoother color.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. When I mean, the last big printer I had was my 7600 and a 3800. Were the last two Epson printers that I had that were large. And honestly, I couldn't tell a difference between the two of them.
The quality that came out of them.
Correct. Yeah, right. Correct.
I'm just wondering if one of them will hold up longer or clog less or require less maintenance or easier, actually be able to be fixed versus these, which are like, well, the print head's going to cost you the price of a new printer. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, when you get up to the professional printers, does Epson see them differently? Are they different? Are they a different level of product? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense. It feels like the non-pro printers are treated as
disposable.
Yeah, the entire thing is a consumable.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Whereas if you're getting, I don't know, one of the F series where it's, you know, 44 inches wide and, you know, comes with a service plan, like all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
I don't know, man. Is that, I don't know.
Because, you know, you talk to people and they say, you know what, whether you use the printer or not, in 5 years, the print head's going to need replacement or die. You see what I'm saying? Basically,
depending like how much you shoot. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are people who say, you know, oh, it's because I didn't print enough and I left it there and it got clogged. And then other people say, well, yeah, but had you used it a lot, it would have clogged up from use versus non-use. Basically, either way you slice it, you're done in 5 years. You know, yeah. Or whatever it is. I just hate the idea that I have this printer with brand new inks on it that is giving me clogs and problems and black ink along the edge of prints and whatever else. And I'm just going to put it on the street and it's going to end up in a landfill somewhere. Like, that really upsets me. So I ended up just having stuff printed by Adorama. It ended up costing me $4 a piece, so it was like...
Was it inkjet print, or was it chemical? Was
they
that
were
the Fuji
C-prints.
Crystal Archive paper?
C-prints, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But they were $4 a piece. I mean, I had a 20% coupon or whatever it is, but, you know, my agent wanted 20 different prints for portfolio that she was going to show, and so I ended up spending $100-something on prints, you know, to get 20-something prints made, you know? The reason why I didn't jump on that Canon too also is that apparently it has problems doing 11x14 borderless.
Yeah, you mentioned that. What did you read that somewhere?
Yeah, I did read that somewhere. Canon printer. Yeah, it's like some weird limitation of their software. Yeah, Red River. There's a whole article called "How to Print Borderless 11x14 on a Canon Printer." This goes for the Pro 100, Pro 10, and 9000 Mark II. So I'm assuming, yeah, the 100, the 10, the Pro 1. So yeah, so it's basically,
yeah,
there's a way to hack it, but
it feels really weird. I mean, I am no printer designer, obviously, but it seems like at some point it's just the 24 inch versions are just a bigger version of the same mechanism that's in a 13 inch, you know, like the carriage is just wider. There's not, yep. It doesn't feel like there's any really substantially different tech in there.
Right. Yeah.
And yet the difference in price is, it seems disproportionate to,
wait, from a which to which,
from say a 13 inch to a 24 inch.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. 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 You think it's just because people are using them differently or people. See, here's the thing. Okay, let's say this printer is $1,400 right now, right? Whatever. Assuming
this is the P5000 that you're looking at.
The P5000, yeah.
So Epson P5000 listeners.
I'm just picking this out of the blue because it's at the level that I'm thinking I'd want to buy with the size cartridges and whatever. I mean, the ink alone makes it worth it. If I bought a $700 printer and bought enough ink to fill 200 mil cartridges, that's $2,000 versus $1,400. Like, it makes sense. Just from a ink point of view, you know.
If it comes with a full complement of ink.
Yeah, but even if it's 120 mil cartridges to begin with, it's still worth it, you know, because it's $250 a set and they're 24. You know what I mean? Do the math. But, and if I said to the listeners, I said, look, people who like my work, you can have any print you want up to 17 by whatever the size this thing does, right? $150 a piece, right? You know, custom prints, right? And I knew 10 people were going to buy them. That pays for my printer. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, there are ways, but just sort of blindly saying, I'm going to drop $1,500 on a printer that I don't know that I'm going to use or when I'm going to sell prints or whatever it is, it's much harder to justify. And we had a couple of people write in, listeners of the show, one of whom who said, you know, I started selling silver prints, 5x7 silver prints off my Instagram, and I sold a couple, but not that many.
Right.
With another guy this morning who wrote in saying that he bought a Canon 6400, which is big. That's a pretty big one, right? And then he bought a Pro 4000, which is also a big printer. with a laminator so he could like stick things on gator board and stretch canvases and also all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's a serious operation. That's not, hey, I need to print some things from my portfolio or something. That's a pretty...
Right. But he did over 2,500 prints over the course of 11 months. That's a ton of prints.
Yeah,
that's like a dozen or more a day. I haven't done the exact math.
That Pro 4000 is a giant. That's a 44-inch printer.
Holy crap! That's how much do they charge for that?
$4,500.
Right, it's a $5,000 printer. So I mean, I guess if you're at that level, and you know you're going to be selling the prints, and you know what I mean, like you can justify it. If I knew I was selling three prints a month at $200 a piece, then it's a no-brainer. Right? Buy the $1,500 printer. It'll pay for itself in 3-4 months. But if you don't, man, going to Elko or going to, you know, Adorama for the few times a year that you need prints, it's like, I don't mean to beleaguer this. We can get off the topic. I'm really stuck. I feel paralyzed by indecision on what to do. Because I have to...
Well, it's the... If you're ordering from, you know, if you're outsourcing printing,
you got to wait.
You've got to wait. If you're having them drop ship, now you can't sign it, number it, title it.
Yep.
That kind of thing. You make far less in terms of your net, you know. I mean, we talked a couple of weeks ago where the Hanamule 16x20s are $35, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great, but it's not going to cost you that much if you bought 25 sheets of photo rag and printed it yourself. So
there are still $10 a sheet.
Yeah, I mean, it works out to like $6 a sheet for that size.
What is the idea with a 17-inch printer that you use 25 by 17 and do 16 by 24 on that size sheet, that kind of thing, with like a border?
Yeah,
is that the way people think about it?
Yeah, 16 by 24 would be closer to the aspect ratio that you're doing. Yeah,
and you've done paper rolls.
No, I've never printed roll paper. I've always only done sheet goods.
These high end printers have a cutter built in.
Yeah, my 76 had a cutter built in where you could. I had a roll of paper. I just never used it.
So it just unrolls, and when it gets to where is the right length, it cuts it itself nice and clean, so it looks like a sheet that you just had pulled out.
Correct.
And those things are reliable. It feels like it's a little like, oh, I don't know about that.
They're supposed to be. Again, no firsthand experience.
Yeah.
Man,
that's
and they'll
tricky.
Cut canvas. And the lab around the corner of my house, from my house at the time, that's what he used. Nothing but roll goods, both paper and canvas, and never had a problem to my knowledge.
Interesting. Okay. I don't know. I just thought if anybody else had any thoughts on the matter, or if a bunch of you want to buy prints and I can pay for this thing. I don't know what to do. I really I feel like I need a new printer, and then having a big giant printer like that, it's big. You know, you had one in your old place.
Mm-hmm. The 24-inch printers are not humongous. I mean, I think the 76, if memory serves, maybe 75 pounds or so. I mean, I carried it up the stairs myself, so it wasn't that bad. I was looking at a 9800 over the weekend, and I mean, that's a nearly 70-inch long carriage, and it weighs 200 pounds.
So the equivalent now is the P6000, I guess, is the 24-inch?
Probably, yeah. The P6000, I think that comes in a 24. I think there's also a 44-inch version of it as well.
That's a big printer.
Yeah.
I think that if I could get my ink costs way down by having big cartridges in it, even like that 17-inch one, I'd be more likely just to print stuff for fun. You know what I mean? Just to have it in a box.
Well, and a lot of people use third-party inks, you know? There's a company in England called Lyson.
Lyson, yep.
Yeah, a lot less expensive. I mean, look, that's where these companies make the bulk of their money. It's not in the hardware. It's in the consumables.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, enough of that. I just wondered if you had any further thoughts or if you're kind of thinking the same way I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could find one.
Yeah, you'd buy a 24-inch and then put a bunch of new inks in it. And
absolutely. Yeah.
Do you really need something that big?
I have several things that I could use a 24-inch printer for. Yes. Like tomorrow could start printing the things that I have in my head And yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Anyway.
Now, if you want to take a road trip to Frisco, Texas, Bill.
Yep. Who's in Frisco?
There is an Epson SureColor P6000, never used, 24-inch large format color printer. Current bid is $660. Ends in a day and 4 hours.
But you got to pick it up in Texas.
Well, no, it's $200 for shipping. He'll crate it up and send it.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's not bad.
No. You buy that thing for $1,000 with shipping, done.
Yeah. Well, there we go. There's the answer. Yeah, I like this P5000. Does this thing get good reviews?
Should.
Yeah?
Yeah, should.
That's a good deal. $400 mail-in rebate.
Yeah. All right, moving on.
Yep. Final thing. What else we got? Where we talked about that NASA camera that got fried last week. Apparently, the launch started a brush fire. It was the brush fire that engulfed the camera.
Okay. All right.
So there we go. There's the
mystery
solved. Not
the blast, because it looked like it was pretty far away.
Exactly. Thank you, Bradley, for sending that in. Yep, makes more sense. See, Jeffrey, there's always a reason.
It's always a reason.
Mike Kukovica sent in a quick question here. Do you want to read that one?
Yeah, sure. Mike, thanks for the question, by the way. If you've got one, this sounds like an ad, doesn't it? Hey, if you've got a question, just send it to us, podcast it on takingpictures.com, or use hashtag AskOTP in the Twitters.
Yep.
Mike writes, I've been wondering, does print size play a role? Oh, a printer question. Okay. Play a role in choosing depth of field in your photos, or is it off-putting to have a large sized image on screen or print with a very shallow depth of field? I've been making my photos as destined to be prints, and I feel like maybe it's better to have deeper depth of field when it's large so that the viewer has more detail to look at. But at the same time, I love shallow depth of field images. Just wondering what your take is.
Thoughts?
I don't care. I think it's whatever you're trying to say with the image. Where do you want me to look as a viewer? What do you want me to focus on? What do you want me to concentrate on? That's where you get to make those choices. Yeah. I know several photographers that have, 1.2, 1.4 lenses, and by and large, that's where they shoot all the time. And to me, that gets a little boring because you're eliminating your ability to push and pull our connection to the entire scene and only having us as a viewer focus on the item that is in sharp focus. When something soft, something slightly out of focus, something not quite in the frame, those are all choices that you get to make to create the overall composition. Thoughts? Yeah.
I agree with everything you just said from an artistic point of view. From a technical point of view, the smaller something's printed or viewed, the less you're going to notice things that are out of focus. So, there are pictures that I take that I use for my little Instagram feed that if I look at it on my 5K screen, I'm like, whoa, that background's really out of focus. And somehow you look at it at 600 pixels on a phone and you go, oh, wow, everything looks like it's in focus, so there is a ratio of print size to, depth of field as far as perception of what is and is not out of focus. Same is true, by the way, for a picture that is, if you shoot a portrait with a D810 that's a little out of focus of a, person or whatever it is, and you print it out 30 inches or you print it out 4x6, you can get away with a lot of things that are at 4x6 that you can't get at 30 inches. Absolute sharpness and that kind of stuff, or absolute focus perfection, if that's what you're going for, is more noticeable the bigger the print is, obviously. And now most of these cameras are so high res that things that you think look out of focus on the screen, you print it out and you go, yeah, I can't even tell. it's an 11 by 14 and I can't even tell that's out of focus just because I'm binning just to get it down to 11 by 14, which is nuts. Back in the old days, you'd have to up res to get 11 by 14. I think that personally, the large images, the large giant prints that I like most generally are stop down and have more stuff in focus just because I like to look at them like paintings. Mm-hmm. That's my two cents. Although, you know,
but again, I think it depends on the subject matter.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. There are also some really beautiful short depth of field, large portraits where you're, you know, you're the size of a person's head and it's on the wall and the only thing in focus are their eyelashes or whatever, you know?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's actually kind of cool too sometimes. So yeah, it just depends on what you're doing, but size does play a role in how out of focus it looks. It may be that if you know you're going to print really big, maybe you don't stay open to 1.2 or 1.4. You stop down to F2. So, you know what I mean? Like there, that there's...
You've got a little bit more wiggle room.
Exactly.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So there you go, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Photographer of the week. We have two of them here. Is this true or...
It is true. It is true. And there's a story behind it.
Could this be true, Jeffrey?
It is in fact true. Buckle up, kids.
Oh, boy.
We've got two of them. No. Alessandro Amato del Monte. And Alessandro, I hope I am pronouncing your name correctly. Either way, absolutely one of the coolest names ever.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, so Alessandro has written in a few times asking us to include some Italian photographers of the week. And, you know, we've got a fairly long running list that we're pulling from, and then, you know, we'll call audibles every once in a while, and sometimes we just forget. So as a gesture of thanks and goodwill, I'd like to include both of these. They're both really terrific photographers, and with our thanks and apologies, Alessandro, for
to the Italians.
No. To Alessandro for missing his requests.
I thought you were apologizing to Italy. I was like,
well, I do feel a little bad. So first one, Francesco. I'm going to assume that this is Francesco Cito. Could you think C I T O? I would think that there's a ch in there, right?
Yes, depending on where she lives, but yes.
Okay, so Francesco Cito. And I'm probably butchering that, and I'm sorry, Alessandro. I'm a horrible pronouncer of things. Anyway, photographer, this site is, it looks like it is black and white. Yeah. The bio is available in Italian as well as English. Reportage photographer, really, really good.
Yeah.
Like really, really good. Up close and personal, so really does kind of stick to that, like the Kappa quote, which may or may not be accurate. If your photos aren't good enough, you're not close enough. You know, another one of these photographers that really does get into the thick of what they shoot. And some of these things, man, you know, there's a set from Palestine, 83 to 2011. Powerful photographs. Conflict photographs are still some of my favorite things to look at. They're hard to look at, but massive respect for those people who put themselves in harm's way to educate us to what's going on in the world.
Yeah, beautiful stuff. And the tones of the black and white is actually gorgeous too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing really ever goes to that really super contrasty black.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's really nice toning.
Yeah. Even the black stuff feels like you could almost see some detail in it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a set called The Mysteries of Campobasso.
Yeah.
The Festival of the Mysteries of Campobasso is one of the most important and fascinating events of popular culture of religious, what is that? M-O-L-I, Molise? Is that how you would say that? Molise?
Yeah, Molise. Yeah.
It takes place on the day of Corpus Christi, and the procession of 13 mysteries along the streets of the historic center, and represent, quote, living pictures of the Old and New Testament, end quote. Children, seniors, and adults dressed in colorful clothes represent angels, saints, and demons are anchored in the structures and blah, blah. Okay, so
yeah, that's
interesting.
Terrifying.
Interesting that. Colorful clothes. So it is a colorful ceremony
that he's shooting in black and white.
Yeah, shooting in black and white. So we're really focused on composition and tone and value, and it's fascinating. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I was I ended up on a float in a Memorial Day parade yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on my back taking some pictures with my Leica, and I realized I had black and white film, and there's, you know, tons of American flags in the shot and whatever it is, all these like colors and things. And I'm like, am I completely missing this by shooting this in black and white?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I go
without seeing them and seeing photographs like this, I would say no.
Yeah.
There is a compellingness.
Sure.
To it. Right.
Yeah. Yep. 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 Francesco Cito.
Okay. So that's number one.
Excellent.
Number two is Gianni Berengo Gardan.
Ugh.
I hope I'm pronouncing this. That right.
Love this guy. Yep. This is amazing.
Yeah. So first link in here is from the Leica camera blog. Leica Hall of Fame Award for 2017. Gianni Berengo... Maybe, is it Gardan? Would it be a soft G? Jardin or Gardan? Anyway, podcasted on takingpictures.com if you'd like to correct us.
Gardin.
But yeah, beautiful, beautiful work. Yeah, you like this work.
Well, I like mid-20th century Europe kind of looking stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like when Europe, and especially places like Italy or France, felt distinct from one another... because mm-hmm. their cultures were not quite steeped into each other as much as they are now. You know, it didn't become this homogenous European kind of thing like it is, like it feels a lot of times now. I love this kind of stuff where you get to see details of life. Like there's that picture from 1968 of all the guys, the guardians at the mental institution all had the keys on their belt loops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's such a great picture. Stuff like that are really interesting.
And we're seeing basically chest down or waist down. We don't even see, like, they're just these anonymous figures, you know? It's almost like E.T., where you just see the gun and the keys.
Yeah. Do you consider yourself an artist? Answer, no. I see myself more as an artisan. I do not feel like an artist. I'm a photographer. I document my time and the things I see around me. If certain critics decide that one of my photos is a work of art, that's their call, not mine. My personal opinion is that photography should be exclusively about communication rather than art. That's not to say that it can't be influenced by other art forms. I've always taken inspiration from literature, for example. I've read Hemingway, Dos Passos, Faulkner as a Boy. And I imagine landscapes that I would later discover when I visited America. Similarly, the photos I've taken in France were very definitely inspired by Simeon. It's interesting, though, that, this stuff is very, it's very of its time. And I kind of like that, you know, it's like it feels like a little time machine. That's what these kinds of things feel like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. And there's a video, too, that you have here.
Yep. Yep. YouTube video, so and there's a video on this site, on the Leica site, going through photographs, contact sheets, and he's talking a bit about his own work, and I would encourage you to go check that out.
I love St. Mark's Square covered in water, and they have to put up the little walkways.
That.
It's very cool.
Yeah. So
began his career,
Heather.
Jeffrey. Already referred to at the beginning of his career as the Italian Cartier-Bresson.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
I could see that. That makes sense. Interesting. Anyway.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
So thank you, Alessandro. Thank you. Thank you.
I think you have to say his whole name.
Alessandro Amato del Monte. I hope that's how you pronounce it, because that is the coolest name.
Jeffrey's actually changing his name tomorrow to...
Right.
You should, actually. That'd be funny. What if you came back and you're like, I am no longer Jeffrey?
It's a Bond villain name, Alessandro. That's so great. It's like, but you're going to... you're also a fencer. I've got this whole backstory for you, and I don't even know you. And I'm already fascinated by you.
He's like, I work at a shop.
I know. Stop talking about me like that, moron.
Yeah.
So thank you, Alessandro, for sending these in. And again, apologies that it took so long to get to them, but really wonderful work. Thank you.
Agreed.
Stuff that I'd never seen before. Had you ever heard of any of these guys?
No, but then again, I never hear of anybody. So.
Yeah. I rarely leave. One thing before we leave on here. You were a keen amateur photographer before you turned professional. Who were your idols back then? Eugene Smith, certainly, but my hero was Cartier-Bresson. When I started taking photos in the mid-1950s, Cartier-Bresson had just published his masterpiece, The Decisive Moment, which I bought in 1954 as soon as it came out and still cherish to this day, and was at the height of his fame. All photographers, amateurs and professionals alike, idolized him. He was like a god to me. It was while I was looking at the photos in that book that I decided I should become a photojournalist. Boom. Come on.
Okay, topic for next week.
Yeah, okay.
There are some people who would look at Cartier-Bresson's work or the whole idea of the decisive moment and say, oh, that's so passé, that's so early 20th century, we've moved on from that now. Now it's about, you know, social pictures and it's about the, you know, whatever the thing is, right? That like somehow... The pinnacle that a guy like this looks at and says, no, this is what I'm going for. They say, well, yeah, you're behind the times, Pops. We've moved on.
Mm.
Do you understand that that's a thing that people will sometimes say?
I understand that.
Okay, right. Yeah, my question is, can an art form reach a pinnacle to which, after which, it doesn't really get any better, it just gets different? See what I'm saying? And is
why haven't we had another Cartier-Bresson? Why have we not had another Avedon? Why have we not? That is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, like even like that everyone looks back to Cartier-Bresson and they say, this is the guy, this is the person who he defined photography for a generation. There's no one who defines photography for this generation. There's 30 people who define photography for this generation.
Well, I mean, once something has been defined, you know, you can, I think, add nuance, but can you, you know, there will never be another Beatles. There will never be another Elvis.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. That's exactly what I'm talking about. All right. Save it for next week. I want to talk about
it. All right. Next week. All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Save it for next week.
Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yep. But okay. Please go look at this. These two fellows, they're terrific.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just throwing ideas in. Good. Okay, if you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411. We'll leave us a voicemail. We love voicemails. Leave us a question if you got a question. We will take care of that. At Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris, podcast at ontakingpictures.com. You can get a hold of us at all of those places. Does that make sense?
New process driven up probably tomorrow.
Yep.
Conversation with Simon Baxter.
Yep.
Landscape photographer from the north of England who has a lovely dog named Meg who accompanies him everywhere.
Yep.
Go look, go listen, go subscribe. Response has been terrific. Love it.
That's out already or is there?
No, it'll be out tomorrow. I'm finishing up the edit. It's going along really well.
Okay.
Who else is coming up? Kent Hall was just posted last week. Go listen to that if you haven't. He's a guy who makes books and writes poems and takes pictures and makes collages. Anyway, so new PD. Those of you who have listened and liked it,
excellent.
Thank you. Yeah, good stuff.
I think that's
what else?
It.
Is that it?
I think so.
All right, go take some pictures.
Yeah. I have to, actually. Once I get my internet connection worked out, Spectrum, shaking my fist.
If that is your real name.
Yeah. If that's your... Oh, it's not? Oh, it's a company? Oh.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a terrific week. Talk to you soon.
See
you.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. Too many fools, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way. The way